Suzanne takes you down to her place near the river.
And within 6 months of that suicide attempt, I was perfectly fine, and I was invited to India to meet with a high Tibetan Lama to talk about my experiences, and then I ended up living in a Buddhist nunnery in the mountains. But that's
why you... That was Mary Reed, our guest for today's podcast.
And you want to travel with her, and you want to travel blind, and you know that she will trust you.
Hello, I'm Suzanne Taylor. Welcome to my podcast, Searching for Unity in Everything, Meaningful Conversations with Meaningful People. You'll see on my logo, which is my website, Sue Speaks. Sue stands for Searching for Unity in Everything. How can we turn this world around? Can we turn the world around? Well, everything I've done has been in that pursuit, buoyed up by that famous quote by Margaret Mead, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." My guest today is Mary Reed, who was in the corporate world when in 2000 she found herself connected to what was anything but corporate. And it took her 11 years of struggling to cope with what we work to become when she surrendered to it and accepted what she then started to share to help people to see for themselves what had become second nature to her, an accidental mystic who is a gift to us all. These days, she divides her time between the Himalayas and India, where she lives primarily in contemplative silence, and traveling in North America, where she's very noisy and shares her story to inspire us all to rise to our greatest potential. I see you as a tour guide, Mary, who knows every inch of the territory that makes us tick. What was it like when you started to see differently? I know that you had no background in spirituality, that you had a sense that there was more to humanity than we were claiming, what have you, but in a very unspiritual kind of way. And then all of a sudden, you were seeing differently. So can you talk about what it was like to see differently?
Yeah, and actually, it's, I guess the more true statement would be to be embodying differently as opposed to seeing differently. But to give you a little context, I have no religious background whatsoever. Right. It's never made sense to me, the whole religious pursuit. I never had a lot of questions. To me, it was pretty simple. You're just supposed to be kind and do interesting things to help people in the world. So I didn't understand why people went to church to find Jesus and all of these things that were already present in their heart. So from a very young age, religion and spirituality just didn't make sense to me. So I was never a seeker at all. And I just wanted to do interesting things in the world to help people. And I grew up to do that as a healthcare executive in Washington, D.C. And I worked all around the world doing very normal sorts of things. And then in the summer of 2000, I started hearing a voice. That was how this all started unfolding. And then after about 6 months of hearing this voice, the floodgates were just open to these metaphysical experiences. And just to give you an idea of how profound these were, the very first one in December of 2000 was going into the body and being of Jesus on the cross at the moment of crucifixion. And in that experience, re-experiencing how humanity has been evolving since time began. And so a complete picture of humanity's evolution in the context of Christ on the cross. And so this is the profound nature of these experiences. And the very next day, going into those realms again and encountering godlike beings and having a meeting with all of these light beings about the conflict nature of our world. And so there were enormous events, these experiences as they started. And then on Monday morning, I have to go back into my office and do my work in my high rise in Virginia. And so it was really incredibly confusing. And this world looked really insane. It looked so cruel next to the very simple, beautiful wisdom that I was gleaning from these other perspectives. So it was quite confusing to me. And frankly, it was quite painful to me. Yeah.
You know, I'm listening to you. I had not heard you describe how your perception was before these experiences. And I'm telling you, that's just the way I saw the world. In fact, when I was 10, give or take, I said to my father, Daddy, I'm an atheist. And he said, you don't know enough to be an atheist. We didn't have any religion in my house, but I thought just mm-hmm. those things. What is all that stuff? You're just supposed to be good, you mm-hmm. know, and nice, and mm-hmm. it's natural. And what are those people doing with that mm-hmm. weird, you know, people they worship and what have you? So anyway.
Especially because when they would go to the worshiping centers, they would learn about things like sin and judgment and these other things that didn't make any sense to my heart at all.
It must have been very bizarre to you, though, all of a sudden, to see through the eyes of Jesus. I mean, what did you make of that?
It was really deeply confusing because I couldn't talk about it because it was so enormous. The scale, like, where do you even start with that? Any of those events, there's no starting point. It's like having a whole cosmos full of wisdom and then just trying to figure out a starting point to talk about it, to put it in a context. And because I don't have religious background, I don't have language, I don't have framework. So it was incredibly confusing. And then to make matters worse, as these events were continuing, I began to seek help with therapists and doctors and Reiki practitioners and shamans and back to the therapist, and no one could help me. No one could help me understand, why are these things happening to me? What do I do with them in particular? And how do I process all of this? And no one could help me. The people that I was going to for help didn't have the resources or the understanding to be able to help me. So in addition to being very confused, trying to hold these very two different worlds, I was also just failing again and again and again and again to get some kind of foundation of normalcy. And there was no normalcy in my life whatsoever during this period. None.
Yeah, you spent 10 years at this.
10 years of failure. I saw more than 40 practitioners all around the world trying to get help. And it was just failure after failure. And eventually, in the 10th year of holding all of this together, every aspect of normalcy in my life fell apart. And the spiritual stuff is pushing harder and harder. And finally, that just tipped my world upside down, and that culminated in a serious suicide attempt. And that was March 23rd of 2011, and I took 97 prescription pain and sleeping pills with 3 glasses of wine, and then I laid down, I said my prayers, and just assumed that that was it. I haven't spoken about this in a while.
Oh.
And then 2 days later, I just woke up. I woke up entirely on my own. Yeah. I woke up in excruciating pain, and I had no ability to control my motor skills, but I was alive. But I still woke up in the same two worlds that I went to sleep in. So it was then, finally, that I just quit. I quit trying to be normal. I quit trying to fight it. I quit trying to fix it. I quit trying to figure it out. And I remember distinctly saying, you know, God, you can see I have no idea what I'm doing. If there's something that you guys all need me to do, then somebody else is going to have to lead the way. I can't be the project manager for my life anymore. And then in that supreme state of surrender, the whole mystical journey just opened up on its own. And within 6 months of that suicide attempt, I was perfectly fine, and I was invited to India to meet with a high Tibetan Lama to talk about my experiences, and then I ended up living in a Buddhist nunnery in the mountains.
What a story. Actually, the listeners should get your book, Unwitting Mystic, Evolution of the Message of Love, because you start out in the book with details of that suicide attempt, and it's riveting. You've written that in a really very compelling way.
Thank you.
The opening of that book. I mean, you can't put it down.
Well, the reason that I start with that episode in particular is because it's such a miracle right off the bat. And I'm very, as you can see, I'm very meticulous in my planning because I have a medical background. And so I planned everything out. I researched it for months, how to shut my organs down, how to not get sick. And I timed it out at exactly 22 minutes. And so it was very, very careful. There's absolutely no explanation for why I would have lived except that I have something important to do.
Do you have a sense of why were you selected? Why you?
I do have a sense.
Because
that was my second experience. The second metaphysical experience that I had began with me being suspended way, way up in the universe, looking down at planet Earth. And I speak as though the cosmos itself is speaking. And I say, I am the message, and I'm to be revealed in that world as the message. And then I watch my entry into Earth, and it's like a pinprick on the Earth's surface, completely unnoticed by anybody. And then I start seeing these concentric circles going out around and around until I'm encircling the entire planet. And what I didn't realize then, but I've come to understand from that experience, is that what it means to be the message as opposed to the messenger. So I'm not here simply to tell a message. I'm here to embody that message. And so the way that my experiences happen, because I'm such a pure vessel, since I have no filter, I don't have any idea what's true or what I should learn. Everything comes to me in a very pure way, and it's all related to origins of what is pertinent to the human experience for divine wisdom. So the origins of existence, the origins of fear, the origins of thought, the origins of Christianity, the origins of Buddhism, et cetera, et cetera. So all of these things I have embodied literally from the origin experience. So I embody the message of that wisdom, and then I walk out into the world, and that's what I share with people.
Very rare, of course. You know, this is such a rare story. We're all trying to get somewhere, mm-hmm. and it's a life work to be on that path. But go back to that childhood, if you would. Was there anything when you were a child that was, you know, very different?
Many times I have thought, what was I thinking when I planned out my life in another realm, that I must have said, I want the entire continuum of experience from the absolute most abominable to the most glorious, because this has actually been my continuum of experiences, and much of that relates to childhood. So a couple of things. First of all, just in a general kind of metaphysical sense, when I was a young child, I could very easily identify and have Jesus in my heart. Like, I was well aware that I had Jesus. He just lived in my heart. And I didn't understand why everybody didn't have that. That seemed very normal to me. And when I realized that nobody else had that, I knew that there was something that people weren't quite aware of that I seemed to be aware of. So there's that piece. But just from a sort of the normal world experience, my mother left when I was 5. I have 2 siblings, and she left all of us when I was 5. My brother was 6, my sister was 2. So she was a woman who had children and couldn't cope with being a mother. So there was that. So there was the abandonment of the mother figure in my life. But secondly, my father was incredibly violent. He was extremely brutal. He was deeply, deeply wounded, and he took that wounding out on especially my brother and I. So the range of abuse covered all the bases when I was growing up. When I think about, if you want to really embody the lesson of unconditional love and true forgiveness, how else would you be able to do that but in a situation in which your father of all people is the one that's the most violent to you. Mm-hmm. And ironically, my father really loved us. He always let us know that he was proud of us, and he was also incredibly abusive. So I grew up with this, you know, trying to work all of that through. And then my father contracted AIDS in the 80s. So I had a progression of relationship with him of, he was dying, he was living, he was dying, he was living, or whatever. So you have that period of time in which you're able to process all of that, getting to a pure forgiveness state before he died. And he actually died right after I moved to India in the nunnery. So I was in the nunnery when he passed away. I couldn't have been more perfect. So I definitely have that childhood of that sort of set me up for a greater perspective of compassion and understanding, not just for those that are wounded and oppressed, but those that are also the wounded and oppressed that are hurting other people as a result. So I've seen it from all sides.
That makes sense to me, that volatility and the banging around from, you know, pillar to post, whatever, mm-hmm. in that psychological way. That makes sense, that somehow the why you, at least some sense of an explanation of it. Now, obviously, your mission, and, you know, one question I could ask you, what's your mission? But your mission is to share now. And when you talk about people being so much more than they know, would you talk about what is the more? What more are we than that we don't know?
You know, just in July of this year, I had a very big metaphysical experience in which I saw where humanity is going. So we're coming into this huge momentum of integration into a unitive consciousness now by experiencing more and more of our awareness of ourselves as the oneness of life in a oneness, unitive experience. In that experience, I saw very clearly how humanity has been so overwhelmed with this consciousness of inadequacy. We all just feel like we're so inadequate, we're so tiny, we're so unable to fix the world with everything that has to be going on that needs to be fixed and all of this. And in this experience, I saw how so much of our spiritual work in particular holds us in that inadequate consciousness. And in one of the things that came up in this experience was the idea of people say that we're ascending through dimensions. And so in this experience that I was having, I could see very clearly if we think about the fifth dimension, would then be able to experience and be aware of the first, the second, the third, the fourth, and the fifth. Mm-hmm. But the third dimension can't experience the fifth because it's not there. So fundamentally, we start with the belief that we're not already enough, right? This is the basis of the work, begins with that belief. And so then think about the trillionth dimension can experience all of the other dimensions and be aware of that, but the third dimension can't experience this trillionth. And so bridging the gap between the third dimension and the trillionth dimension is simply awakening to the realization that we are already all of this. And in my experience, this is how I've been able to experience all that is. The various pieces of it through Buddha and Jesus, the whole entire thing, and this very moment, because I am all of this. And so my embodiment of this knowing, of this being, is my mission. This is the thing to share with other people to help us realize we are all already all of this. So it's very much a sort of deconditioning that which we've overlaid onto this truth, mm-hmm. taking those pieces apart to awaken to this realization.
Well, what's going on in the trillionth dimension?
All that is.
Can you say more?
You know, I'm often asked the question of what's on the other side of the veil, right? What's that mystery? But I will be perfectly honest, the greatest mystery that I experience from that perspective is what's on this side of the veil. How we have been doing life of this blindness. This is the greater thing for us to realize, right? So when we sort of pull apart all of these pieces, we realize what's really truly here. And that's the same thing that's in all of these other dimensions. It's the state of equality, the state of pure freedom, the state of unconditional acceptance, the state of true oneness and unity. It's a communication beyond the narrative of words and stories and good trumps bad and all of these paradigms of conceptual living. It's living beyond beliefs.
Well, do you think that as individuals, we obviously you're a special case. You just are. But for us who have not had that same dynamic visited upon us, do you see that as something that an individual embodies, or is it we've all got to do it together to get to a mutuality in that more enlightened place?
It entirely happens through the individual vessel. There's no other place that we can make a difference. There's no other place that we can do the work. In here is the only place from which we can react to anything that we're experiencing of life. In here is the only place we are experiencing anything of life. From here is the only place that we can create anew. So it entirely happens through the individual vessel. But in the gathering together, we can make those changes with and through and as each other. There's the philosophy, the African philosophy of Ubuntu, which I dearly love this. I used to work a lot in Africa, and in Southern Africa, they're very fond of this. There's a lot of definitions depending on which tribe you're working with, but I love the one that says, I am who I am through you. We are who we are through each other. And when we realize that all of life is entirely a oneness experience, that we ourselves are the thing that is experiencing all of life, regardless if we perceive it outside of ourselves, the only place we're experiencing it is within. So when we think about other people's hatred or other people's meanness or pain, the only place that we are experiencing that is within us. If I see you being mean, the only place that I'm experiencing your meanness is within me. So it's never outside of me. Mm-hmm. So within this individual vessel, this is where we create that change. This is also the place where all of the divine wisdom that's integrating now into this present realm through this integrative time of unitive consciousness, it only comes in through the individual vessel. So coming in through the individual vessel in a collective environment, is it just magnifies the power of that integration tremendously.
You know, what I find myself most passionate about, mission, whatever, is that we should change our worldview, that we should all get it, that we should be nice to one another, essentially, and that we should care about each other as much as we care about ourselves. We just have to move. And I think that's true. We have to move in that direction. I mean, that's where we're going. Mm-hmm. It makes perfect sense in the abstract. Of course, we're the vessel and we've got to do it ourselves. How do you create that in your own little private sphere when things are so impinging on you from the collective?
In any given situation, the easiest question to start with is, what's missing here? What's missing from this situation? And always, when it's a painful situation, the answer is love, true love. Genuine love, not the idea of love that says there's a right and a wrong here, but genuine love that's based in equality and freedom, acceptance and unity. And so when we realize that love is the thing that's missing, then the next question is, am I willing to be this presence of divine love? And usually the answer when it's a troubling situation is no, because it feels really good to be pissed off. It feels really good to be righteous and judgmental and angry and resentful and hurt and all of these other things. So the truth within us in this very moment, whatever that truth is, hurt, angry, resentful, mistrusting, whatever it is just part of the experience, but it's not all of the experience. So in the greater, if we let all of that simply be within us, within our own being, a state in which all of it is allowed to be here, equal, free, unconditionally accepted, in a state of unity, and we allow all of that just to be, what we get to at the deeper level then is recognizing the pain that we were trying to reject in this situation. Whether we feel that that pain was ours or we perceive it as the motivation that prompted somebody else to hurt us. Once we get to that point of finding the pain that we were trying to reject, and we allow that pain too to be part of everything else that's going on, then we have answered what that pain is crying out for. What that pain is crying out for is to be loved. And that's usually what we're trying to do away with when we're angry or resentful or pushing away the experience. You can apply this to absolutely anything in life. When we get to that point where we recognize the pain that we're trying to reject and we allow that to be part of the experience, everything shifts. In that very moment, everything shifts because we've answered what the cry is seeking.
That would be very good to work on, you know, seriously.
This is the core of all of my teachings comes down to the question of, am I willing? That's the entire practice. Am I willing to be a presence of divine love? Because most of the time, the answer is no. And then when you have that profound realization, I just said no. Like, the world is crying out for love, and I'm not willing. You see, if it was really easy, we would already have it. But the willingness is, we don't really ask that question of willingness. We want the other person to do it.
Do you have any thoughts for, aside from the good work you're already doing, obviously, but any kind of, like, for instance, I got involved with crop circles, and, you know, I have a whole track of involvement with them because I thought they could change consciousness. I thought that if everybody knew there was another intelligence visiting us, we'd have to think again. So I've always looked at, well, what other things would make us talk to one another in a more peaceful way to arrive at new understandings. And do you have any ideas for how that might come to pass?
I don't think that there's one piece to that, because everybody's so different and everybody can hear different things. Everybody are coming from different perspectives, which is beautiful. That's part of the beauty of our tapestry of life. So I think that having different people, bringing people together, this is one of the things that I end my talks with, which is gather people together with a new common intention. Our old common intentions were to use old doctrine or old dogmas that don't work anymore. You can see in our world, it hasn't worked. And so finding a new common intention to bring people together to look from new perspectives, from new vantage points about all that's going on in order to respond differently than we have in the past. I'll give you a very interesting example of this. When the events were going on around Charlottesville, the racist marches and riots and things, there was a group, I don't remember what town it was in, but there was a march that was going to happen through with a hate group. And the local community found out about it. And rather than standing outside with protest signs and yelling at them, encouraging them on, essentially, they decided to turn that march into a fundraiser for the civil rights groups. So they sponsored the people that were walking in the march. And they set up water stations and banana stations, and they were holding up signs every block. Congratulations, you've now raised however much money for whatever civil rights groups. And then they had no fuel. So they're like, well, we're not going to continue marching because now we're just raising money for the other groups. So you see, it was a creative response that wasn't in the same resisting and fighting way. It was like, all right, this is already happening. So how can we work with this?
Oh, that's beautiful.
You see, it was a completely different ideology that they brought to the table. And this is the thing that I think is starting to happen anew. And I often talk about Malala Yousafzai in the same way, the young girl that was shot in the head by the Taliban for promoting education for girls in Pakistan. She was once asked, do you know the person who shot you? And she said, I wasn't shot by a person. I was shot by an ideology. And so her response was not in the same ideology of power and domination and war. She didn't go to the United Nations and say, you know, we need to fight the Taliban. She went to the United Nations and said, we all need to make education for girls a priority. So her response was based in the identity of love, equality and freedom, acceptance and unity.
Yeah.
You see, so it's just a different way of responding to what's happened. Reaction is always the key to creating something anew.
Yeah, all of those things are just elementally intelligent. And then I'm always saying, well, how do we make that all happen? You know, one of the things that in my evolutionary idea catalog is, why don't we get an advertising agency or advertising agencies to make a campaign to teach us all these things, you know? Wouldn't that be smart?
Well, I think that's sort of what's happening in gatherings like this. We're being the advertising campaigns. I do. This is how it happens. This is how the ripples go out. And it's not to underestimate a powerful little channel that opens out these ripples. Mm. It's really effective. That's how the tapestry changes. Mm-hmm. Because it's all an interwovenness. At the metaphysical level, it looks like a multidimensional kaleidoscope. So you can imagine these patterns that are turning. As one turns, it affects everything. This is exactly how it's happening.
Well, you know, I'm back to, so how can it happen in everybody's house?
But here's the thing, Suzanne. We, in our own life, we don't want to jump from age 9 to 90.
Oh.
Right? We have so much life to explore and discover and the nuances to experience and the wonder and the fascination and the falling in love with all of this stuff. And evolution of humanity is no different. The unit of consciousness is seeking that same exploration of wonder and awe of all that we're capable of. It's a falling in love with everything that we've been doing from all angles. And that includes the unfolding process of this awakening. From this perspective, I am madly in love with all of it. I'm totally fascinated with every step along the way. I'm not one that's hoping for the leap. I'm loving the unfolding.
When I was a kid, there was a litmus test. Do you believe in God? And that was always a hard question for me because what is God?
You know? Right, that's right.
So I wonder now, you don't actually hear that now. In L.A. you don't. I don't know about the middle of the country. But it meant something, too. There is something to the question if you take the word God out of it. But how would you describe the godness that we would say, oh, yes, we do ascribe to that.
I can do this very easily.
Oh, good.
And I, again, everything that I speak about, I speak from direct embodied experience, not from a studied perspective or a belief. And so many times I have gone back into the primordial ground, the origins, let's say, of the God source itself, if you will. And this primordial ground, this state of being, is an exquisite void. It's unlike anything we know in earthly existence. It's, imagine the cosmos before there's any galaxies or any stars. It's this vast, infinite, eternal void. And all of this void is purely aware. It is fundamentally awareness itself. And all of that awareness has a nature. and that nature is purely cherishing. So from my experience, the primordial state of being is pure cherishing awareness. There is not something that is aware and cherishing. There is fundamentally only awareness that is cherishing itself. And so in my experience, God is not a mystery. It is the awareness of life, being aware of and cherishing itself. And that means all of us.
That's good. I like it. I'll see you. I love one thing you said about yourself, but maybe there's more. You said, I love to dance. In the words of that wise spiritual teacher, the little prince, these are the matters of real consequence.
That's right.
Is there more to what gives you satisfaction? Yeah, why don't you talk some about what gives you personal satisfaction?
I talk all the time about, it's quite cliche to say, do what brings you joy. But when you think about what happens when you're doing what brings you joy, you're in a natural state of cherishing what you're aware of, right? So you're right back into that buoyant, natural state of your own true nature, doing what brings you joy. And so dancing and music and gathering with people, studying spirituality, if you want to be an activist from the joyful perspective, whatever brings you joy, it's such a powerful open door for us. And pretty much my entire life now is every choice I make, is this a joyful endeavor? Then yes, I'll do it. Yes, I'll do it. It doesn't matter if it's a dance or if it's a song in the shower or if it's a gathering in front of a big audience, whatever it is, joyful, I'm in it.
That's so beautiful. It's beautiful because you've so disengaged from the greed world and the world where making more money than other people is relevant to you. And you know, you listen, you go, oh, yeah, that would be good. That would be better than all the money in the world.
You know? But, you know, at the same time, part of what my job is, part of what my being here is to love all of that as well. And so it's not that my world is better now than the old world. It's that I love what's happening because I understand why it's happening. I understand the momentum that created it. I understand the momentum that's at play in all of it in the world and how that's engaging, how we're bringing this other piece now for that to be a reflection and an option for other people now. So that too is a joy to me.
It's wonderful listening to you. You know, it's like hearing the voice of knowing. It's hard for me to listen to preaching anymore, but I love listening to knowing.
Well, you know, there's a couple of things with that. First of all, anytime that I come into a conversation with people, I invite knowing to speak. That's exactly how I phrase it. I invite the knowing of truth to be spoken. You know, our heart can tell the difference between an imposition of doctrine or belief and resonance with truth. I just offer the truth that I have within me and trust the heart can hear that.
Well, it is a real pleasure to talk to you, Mary, and I could talk forever, and I hope that we will talk some more after this. And we have a lovely audience here, so we're going to turn it over to questions and answers after this.
I just want to say, Suzanne, first of all, thank you for the invitation to do this, but also I want to reiterate what an important role you have. And it's really beautiful to watch how you gather. You gather so sincerely with the eagerness to help, to illuminate. And that's really such an important thing. So thank you for all that you're doing for all of us.
Oh, that's so sweet. Thank you so much. I love doing this, you know.
I can tell.
Thank you for gracing my space.
My pleasure.
Now Suzanne takes your hand and she leads you to the river.
So, dear listeners, thank you for tuning into this episode of Searching for Unity in Everything, Meaningful Conversations with Meaningful People. Be sure to check out suespeaks.org/podcast, where you can find out more about our guests, subscribe to our podcast, and leave your comments and feedback. We'd love to hear from you. How did you feel about what you heard? Did you learn anything? Or were you inspired to act in any new way? Or do you perhaps disagree with anything that was said? Also, while you're on our website, do explore and comment on some of the other content. There's a cup of consciousness for everyone.
And you want to travel with her, and you want to travel blind, and you know you can trust her, for she's touched you. Perfect.